Hello, and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Once in a while, a book will come along purporting to be the next big thing in how people perceive, discuss, and or enjoy the national pastime. These are usually written by someone in the broadcasting industry, which makes sense. Someone who sees hundreds of games a year and can offer such insight with no particular allegiance to a specific team or player? Brian Kenny is one such person. A broadcaster slash analyst for the MLB Network, his new book, Ahead of the Curve, offers an interesting examination of some of the flaws in the sport, both in recent years, as time has changed the way the game is played, and historically, when you really think about it. I had the chance to talk with Kenny recently about some of his theories and how long it might take for the baseball establishment to come around to his way of thinking. Brian Kenny, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Now, I'm good to talk.
Well, one of the knocks on the analytic community comes when you try to compare a player from, let's say, Babe Ruth's era with someone more contemporary. So given the evolution in equipment, the increase in night games, the transcontinental travel, the influx of black and Latin players, etc., what would you say is the most fair way to handle this?
Well, it's not going to be perfect, but all you can do is use the tools that are there and try to make your own adjustments. But, you know, at least you start with something objective, and that's using the run scoring environment from each era. And there are ways of doing that, you know, with OPS plus, weighted runs created plus, so you can make a proper comparison between what a guy is doing, say, in the 1970s, comparative dead ball era, and the 1930s, say, you know, explosive offensive era. Beyond that, you know, it's really something that you just have to explore and try to figure out, okay, at what point did integration blossom to the point where the league was fully mature? Then as worldwide players got involved and made the game, you know, more expansive and more competitive to where we are now, you know, that's something I don't think you're going to do perfectly, but all you can do is measure the dominance within the time period that the player played.
Well, that is one of the nice things about baseball is it's fun to argue about these things. It's fun to think of what Babe Ruth would do if he had to face a closer in the ninth inning who throws 105 miles an hour. Since your book is primarily about math, are there any studies that break down the percentages of fans who have embraced sabermetrics versus those who are more old school, for lack of a better word?
I don't know. I haven't seen studies on that, so I'm unaware of that. But I mean, my book is really—it's not about math. It's about just logical thinking and about why, you know, more human behavior and why we resist good information. And part of the challenge of writing the book was actually, you know, pertinent to your question, in that I'm writing it for a mainstream fan, while figuring that someone who is sabermetrically literate will still find it interesting. I think, you know, judging from the people that have enjoyed the book now, I think the sabermetric population is still small. You know, most of the fans that have come up to me, even at this All-Star break, I was at the All-Star game last night, and people were coming to me after I finished my show. I was right there in Petco Park, and so many came up and were saying, well, you really changed the way I think about baseball, and it makes me think when I, you know, as I've read it, a lot of people have read it already, and I realize, wow, there's a lot of, you know, smart baseball fans that just haven't been in this niche of reading the internet sites, of having grown up on Bill James, and still love baseball, still follow the stats, but haven't had access to this. So, and that's part of the reason why I wrote the book. You know, if you think, and I even thought this, that, well, Moneyball explained it. Okay, fine. Then Moneyball, the movie, explained it to everybody else, you know, in the media. And, you know, there's a mainstream movie hit with Brad Pitt. And yet, still, there's a significant, you know, part of the baseball fan population, and probably the majority, that is still, you know, getting this information as new. And that's why I wrote the book. I realized, wait, this is not taken over, you know, completely with the fan base as of yet. It's still in a small niche.
Now, in your book, you write about the difficulties you have in getting some of your colleagues to accept these, I hesitate to even call them new premises anymore, because Bill James is around, has been around for a long time. Can you think of a way to categorize who accepts and who doesn't? Are the players who serve as commentators now, are they more likely to be resistant to this, or more likely to be accepting?
Oh, the players now are fully accepting, because the players now are using all of these tools. These players, they want constant feedback, and they get constant feedback with the technology. They can study their swings. They can study their swing torque. They can look at video. They can, you know, measure themselves. They can look at their own stats. They can reverse engineer their own performance. And certain pitchers and players have done so. You know, Brandon McCarthy is one of them that realized, hey, you know what? I want to pitch like Roy Halladay. What did Roy Halladay get? He, you know, what percentage of ground balls? You know, what was his pitch repertoire? Okay, he has this pitch. Let me develop that pitch. He would develop that pitch. He got more ground balls. He became more like Roy Halladay, got himself a big contract. You can do these things, and the players now are totally into this. And they're very sophisticated in how they study things. There's a few, obviously, players that, you know, just out there performing and just doing this intuitively, but more and more they're using tools to gauge their own performance. And by the time this generation of players is retiring and they're getting into the media, it's going to be a very different conversation.
But what about your colleagues on the TV shows and the radio shows that you do? You know, the former players, are they accepting, or do they think more in terms of, well, it wasn't like this when I was playing? I'm thinking of, like, the guys in the every broadcast booth has an old player or an older player, like a Keith Hernandez or a Ron Darling. Are they accepting of these things?
Oh, yeah, they are. I mean, it depends on the player. It depends on each individual player. And I think there's been huge strides over the last, say, 5 years. I know with my own colleagues at MLB Network, when I first got there, I was like the first, you know, sabermetric thinker they had come across, and they would look at me like I had five heads. But, you know, through the years, they've seen this sweep through the industry. You know, I've been speaking to them constantly. They've done shows like Top 10 Right Now in the off season, where we compare our top 10 lists position by position, which is an excellent exercise in comparative analysis. And, you know, you're forced to think, and you're forced to back up your opinions. And that happening constantly, I tell you what, I write it in the book. The difference now in that one show, in Top 10 Right Now, now as compared to 5 years ago, is incredible. Now, often, we have this formula that we call the shredder. And, you know, like we have this big computer spitting out a list. And it used to be that people used to make fun, the players would say, I'm going to shred the shredder, and the shredder is broken, and you better take it in for repairs. And now, quite often, the ex-players list is closer to the shredders than mine. So we've really gotten very far in terms of just evidence-based logic. That's all, just using evidence to back up your thoughts. And if you like a player, think about why you like the player. Well, he does the little things. Well, measure those little things, base running, you know, fielding, which is not such a little thing, but all those extra things, and back it up. And we've come a long way in that regard. And by the way, I've worked with Ron Darling a lot in the off season, and he's very fluid in his thinking. So even guys who played in the 80s and 90s are capable of learning and evolving.
Now, I want to go back to the human factor that you mentioned a couple minutes ago. Sabermetrics can't take into consideration if a player is feeling under the weather or had an argument with his wife or is distracted and makes an error. I'm thinking of the scene in Bull Durham when Crash Davis strikes out because he's too preoccupied thinking about Annie Savoy. So what if some of these numbers just don't work?
Well, the numbers work. They're just not perfect. But we know that. Like, the trick isn't to find things that you can't measure. That's easy. You know, everything, the whole world is out there that's difficult to measure. What can you measure? And you do the best that you can. I know Joe Maddon is one of the foremost proponents of this new age of thinking. And I asked him, he was managing the Rays, this was about 2 years ago, and on my radio show, I had a good, you know, 15 minutes with him. And at the time, a lot of his players were underperforming. And I said, Joe, you have all these players underperforming from Evan Longoria on. How do you attack that? Like, is it mechanical? Do you go to video? Is it your coaches? How do you look at the heat maps on where guys are pitching you? How do you reevaluate and say, how do I get all of these guys back? You're slumping. How do I get you hot? You know, that's the same thing, except how do you do it team-wide? And he said, I like the question. He said, what I found is it's very rarely mechanical, which surprised me because all the players that I deal with, like at the network, they're constantly seeing, hey, this guy's hands are too low, or this guy is getting behind the ball. You know, they're very mechanically oriented as far as performance. And I thought Joe Maddon would tell me, hey, you know, we get in, you know, we examine the video, we look at, you know, what's working, what's not working, we do some positive thinking, all that stuff. No, he said, what I want to know is from a hitter, when you're walking to the plate and you step in and you look out at the pitcher, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, no, I thought, what are you thinking about?
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? What are you thinking about? More often than not, and we're human beings, and when you're in that competition, even though you're very used to it, even though you're a professional, your mind can get clouded. Your mind can get, you know, blurry. You fear failure. All these things can mix in. You have to open your mind, and it seems easy. But I thought it was fascinating. There's Joe Maddon saying, no, the game is psychological. So the things you're talking about, things are not great at home, you know, you're injured, you're tired, you're cranky, you don't like your team, you don't like your city. Yeah, probably the biggest form, and this is not sabermetrics, but it's just logical thinking. How do we maximize the performance of the player? Well, it's probably looking into his life and figuring out how do we make you happy so you can perform at your peak efficiency.
I thought your philosophy on pitching was very interesting. You discussed that wins are not a fair indication of the quality of a pitcher, and in a chapter called Bullpenning, you discuss a fairly unique way of using pitchers split up over the course of the game. Can you talk about that briefly?
Well, if we were inventing baseball now and we had a team, there's no way we would bring a guy out in the first inning and see how long he could go. let's see how long he can pitch until he's exhausted. There's no way we'd do it. We would bring in one guy at the start, throwing full throttle, knowing that most runs are scored in baseball in the first inning, not in the ninth inning, the first inning, when you can set the lineup exactly the way you want it, and when a pitcher might not be sharp. Why not throw out your best pitcher, a guy who is trained to get three outs or six outs, so he hits the ground running immediately? And by the way, we saw that with the All-Star game this year. Ned Yost used a different pitcher every inning. And it does work best when you have a relief pitcher because those guys are trained. They're now wired to, hey, hit the ground running. You are full intensity, full throttle, foaming at the mouth at the moment you get in the game. Not starting slow. Let me pitch backwards. Let me not reveal all my pitches. Nope. Get out there and throw full throttle. So knowing that you can start, and there's no rules that say you can't throw nine pitchers at a team or seven or six, and knowing that bullpen ERA has been lower than starter ERA since the 1950s, knowing that you can run faster when you sprint than when you jog, why don't we throw seven pitchers a game at your opponent? It's much more efficient.
Now, you write about the fact that when it comes to voting for Cy Young's and MVP, the writers are enamored of the total amount of wins, which, as you say, isn't a fair indication. How long do you think it's going to take for that to change, where something more along the lines of your philosophy is accepted more widespread?
I think it's changing greatly year by year. I mean, it's almost dead. The win is almost dead now. It's not taken seriously, except, look, I realize now it's Steven Strasburg, and I even have to be reminded of this. I think he's 12-0 or something like that. I mean, that's eye-catching. To me, it doesn't matter. It just means he's excellent. We know this. But there's better ways of measuring his excellence. And two, he's probably gotten a break here and there. How many, we don't know. And that's the thing. It's not a good measurement. It tells a certain story. And I'd be fascinated to see. Like, at the end of the year, and I think it's changed, and I think the voters are looking less and less at the win-loss record. But it would be an interesting test if, say, Clayton Kershaw's ERA, right? I'm just using ERA. This is simple. If, you know, your runs allowed, your earned runs allowed in your innings. I'm not even getting into more sophisticated analysis. But just your ERA or opponent's OPS, how the batters do against you batter for batter. Let's say Clayton Kershaw is just much better than Steven Strasburg. It's clear cut. His ERA is 1.7. Strasburg's is 2.9. Something like that. We just know he's much better. The innings are the same. Maybe Kershaw even pitches more. And what if Strasburg's like 21-1 and Kershaw's 19-8? Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think happens then? Mm-hmm. Well, and what should happen then? You answer me. What should happen then?
That's a legitimate question.
I mean, I think it's obvious, but what do you think?
Yeah, I have to look at other factors, perhaps. You caught me off guard and unaware, so to intelligently answer that question, I would need more time, which I don't want to waste your time on that. But so, what's your answer?
No, the guy who pitches the most innings and allows the fewest runs, within reason. And what's your fielding independent pitching? Meaning, what is your strikeouts? What's your walks? How many home runs do you allow? You can now also get more sophisticated in what type of contact do you allow. Even when a guy does hit the ball, do you allow weak contact, or are guys hitting line drives and your defense is excellent? In this case, Kershaw wins in everything. And at the end of the year, I think we're probably going to see a gaudy Steven Strasburg win-loss record and a pretty good one for Kershaw. And to answer your question, I'd be interested to see what happens. I think because Kershaw's reputation is so excellent, and the voting, electorate is getting much smarter now, they will go with Kershaw. But it depends on who gets the vote. I mean, the same guys don't get the vote every year. And it's slowly gotten smarter. Actually, it's very quickly gotten smarter. I don't want to say that it hasn't. But it depends on who gets the vote. It would be an interesting test case.
Now, part of the things that go into earned run averages are the defense behind you. And you mentioned that you're not fond of the category for errors. It's not fair because a player might not get to a ball that another player might get to. And even though because it's calculated as a hit, it might affect a pitcher's earned run average. Talk about errors a little bit.
Well, errors made sense in the 19th century at a time when fielders weren't wearing gloves. I mean, imagine this now. Fielders don't have gloves, maybe a little piece of leather on their palms, just to, kind of blunt the sting of the ball a little bit. The field is not the manicured, putting green that we now have. It's kind of a mess. It's chopped up. And players are swinging a table leg for a bat. So they're chopping the ball on the ground. And there are, get this, in a major league game, 12 errors per game. This was in the 1800s, right? This is way back. But this is when they thought, hey, what's important in the game? And they were right. It was a game of singles and errors. Because the ball was not this gleaming white hard baseball that we now use, guys are not hitting, shots into the upper deck. They're just hitting singles. Maybe some doubles if the ball gets through the outfield, you get a triple, maybe, home run. But there weren't even walls out there. So basically, what they decided, and this is Henry Chadwick, Hall of Famer and one of the, brilliant thinkers of baseball, guy who devised the modern box score, he decided, let's not look at slugging percentage because power is not as important as the single versus the error. Now, in this day and age, at the major league level, again, remember, there were 12 errors per game when they thought of errors. Now there is one error per game. One! Between both teams. And that error is usually something obvious because we're not perfect, and it'll bonk right off a shortstop's glove, and we all go, oh, for shame, for shame. And there's the error, and we all feel good about it, right? We've assessed the blame. And yet, if you're watching a game on a regular basis, you'll see all sorts of plays where the right fielder didn't get to it, the second baseman couldn't reach it, or the ball is popped up and it falls in between three guys and it just hits the ground, but it doesn't hit a glove. And by the way, that's not an error. So it's nonsense. We're like chasing this, and it makes no sense. Yet there on the scoreboard, there it is. Runs, hits, errors. It goes back to the 1800s. And we have defensive runs saved. We have ultimate zone rating. We have sophisticated defensive measurements that are not perfect. But errors are just – I don't know any major league team now that really does anything with errors unless a guy really is going through a bad stretch, and usually that's at shortstop where he's committing a ton of errors. But errors are just insignificant as compared to the range of a fielder.
Right, so you're not that crazy about errors. You're not that crazy about wins for pitchers. A lot of people say batting average is a lousy indicator of a batter's success. What do you like?
I like, you know, real indicators of performance. And for hitting, it's weighted runs created plus, which sounds wonky, but all it is, hey, what's the value of a single? What's the value of a double, triple, grounded into a double play, home run? What's the value of these things? And that, you know, level it off to the league run scoring, and that becomes weighted runs created plus. Also, the plus is, means park effects, because
okay,
playing in Dodger Stadium.
For a second. I am not conversant in all of these new numbers. Doesn't that change from pitch to pitch, from moment to moment? The value
what
of these things?
Change?
The values of these things? Like,
okay, well, that's different now. All right. This, like, that is a good question, because weighted runs created plus, like batting average, like on base, like slugging, is context neutral, meaning what you do on the whole. So it's just what you do, and it doesn't matter when you do it or what the score is. Now, if you want to know what's next, and this gets more sophisticated, you want, now you just ask, hey, pitch to pitch, who's on base, what's the run score, how many outs? That's run expectancy. It's a thing called RE24. I know that sounds really wonky. It's just run expectancy. What do you do to change the expectation of scoring a run? Meaning, if you stand up there and there's a man on first, one out, you hit a double. Now it's second and third, one out. You've really changed the chances of scoring a run. You get a lot of credit for that. Now, there's another one that's context-dependent, which is called win probability. Like, what is the chances that your team is going to win before you step up at the plate? And then, what are the chances of your team winning after your at-bat is done? And you call that how much win probability did you add? Win probability added. So there are answers to the question, the specific question you asked, but you have to go to these different numbers.
Since higher is usually better when you're talking about traditional stats, like a higher batting average is better than a lowing average, more home runs are better than fewer home runs, why do you think WAR isn't more accepted? Is it because those numerals are relatively so small? Like if you have a WAR of, and I'm throwing a number out there, 12 for a season, that's considered good. But is that just not sexy enough for a lot of fans?
Well, no, I think, I know at the... for the people that I speak to, you know, the writers still, a lot of the national writers, and for a lot of people in the game, WAR is excellent to a point, meaning and this is the reason I like it, it forces you to confront the totality of a player's contribution, meaning the base running is in there, the fielding is in there. Now, the worry about it, or the, you know, concern about it is that, hey, measuring offense, hitting, we can be pretty accurate with that. Not perfect, but fairly accurate with it. Defense, you know, it's just not going to be perfect. Base running, you do the best you can. It's fairly accurate, but it's not perfect. There's all sorts of contextual things you could throw in there. And so it's not a great number. And so people kind of fight it. But I always look at it that it's, you know, don't make perfect the enemy of the good. It's very good to realize that, hey, wait a second, Starling Marte is actually as good as Jake Lamb this year, even though Lamb is a big-time power hitter and Marte isn't. Why? We know this if we watch baseball. He's a great fielder. He's a great base runner. He's just not a big-time slugger. And at the end of the year, you'll see a guy like, and this, the reason I bring these guys up is because they were in the final vote for the National League All-Star team. And at the end of the year, we might see, oh, Jake Lamb is a big-time slugger. Starling Marte, he hit 13 home runs or whatever he hits, you know, 18 home runs. And you don't think he's that good. And actually, WAR-wise, wins above replacement, Marte is probably going to be a good bit better than Jake Lamb. Why? He fields and he runs. But only WAR is telling you that.
Early on, you write about the importance of appearance. You talk about managers and some look the rugged part, the John Wayne part. They exude confidence. There's something about them. And you call it, I believe, representativeness. Could you define that?
Well, this happens in all walks of life, not just baseball, that we look for people in certain roles that look the part. You know, we're animals. We take visual cues very strongly. And when you look across Major League Baseball, we have this class of ruggedly handsome kind of movie drill sergeant type guy. You know, they're big. They have these, you know, rock jaws, they have huge hands and big shoulders, big heads. And they look like leaders of men. And when I looked across at a bunch of them, I thought, are they being hired because of their skill set and where they came from and their experience? Or are they being hired because of subconscious cues, meaning they're being hired because of their looks? And I think we know the answer to that. And this is not just Major League Baseball. This is not just managers. We know there are obvious studies for CEOs at major corporations are on the, by and large, taller than the average person, even though that has nothing to do with the skills of being a CEO. I have studies in there on voters voting in what ends up being the better-looking candidate. You know, the less you know about a candidate, the more you will go on looks. And that study, you know, is just flat-out correct. That's the way we do it. And so why wouldn't it happen in baseball, where we're still kind of tribal in a way? We look for a leader who looks the part, who looks like he could fight off an enemy tribe or forage for food a little better. And these things are hardwired into us because we're animals. We're herd animals. And there's the leader of our herd. However, when you get into a World Series, you see the decision-making of these managers, and you wonder, how did that guy get that job? Because the looks have nothing to do with the skill set of the job.
Okay, the skill set of the job. So that translates into knowledge. There are managers who have never played at the major league level, so I'm going to put you on the spot with this last question. Can you foresee a time when a woman might be a manager for a professional baseball team?
I can, absolutely. I don't know when that will be, but there's no reason why there shouldn't. Mm-hmm. I write in the book about there are no female umpires in Major League Baseball. And why would that be? There's no reason why a woman can't be out there, because the job is about your eyesight and your decision-making. You don't have to, you don't have to be physically large. You don't have to be a male. You can be a female, but they're not there. And we just accept this. So, yeah, can a woman be a manager of a Major League Baseball team? Of course. Of course, it helps to have some experience. But, you know, a lot of females are playing baseball, but if they're also playing fast-pitch softball, it's not that vastly different to understand exactly the concepts of using a roster. And that can be a male, a female, can be anybody from any nationality. It can be anybody. It does not have to be, and that's what I put in the book, it does not have to be someone who is, you know, white, male, straight, large, and ruggedly handsome.
And we've been talking with Brian Kenny, author of Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution, published by Simon & Schuster. Brian, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Ron, thank you.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Brian Kenny. Visit the blog often for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on baseball books and book culture. If you have any questions, drop us a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com, and stay tuned for news of the next guest, whenever that might be, from the world of baseball publishing. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
If old man Columbus had sat in the stand, had seen Matty pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. To